know that you have created something that has become a classic in music, it's obviously, you feel very uplifted when you hear it, you know, and good in a way, because I feel that my role as an artist really is to help people through my music in a healing sense, or however you want to say it. Hi, this is Gary Wright in the studio for The Dreamweaver.
When it comes to technical innovation in the history of recorded music, names like Thomas Edison and Leo Fender and Les Paul head up any serious list. But as Beatles producer George Martin proved by recording Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band on merely four tracks, it's human creativity that drives the technology, not the other way around. Simon and Garfunkel first used Robert Moog's electronic monstrosity that Moog called a musical synthesizer in 1968 on their Bookends classic song called Save the Life of My Child. It was startling, but Moog's invention was also unwieldy, bulky, and could only play one note at a time, so it was incapable of playing a chord. Meanwhile, an American musician in London named Gary Wright, who first came to our attention as the songwriter keyboard player in the British band Spooky Tooth, Gary used his budding reputation in the London music scene to play on George Harrison's landmark solo album All Things Must Pass. The friendship Gary Wright struck up then with the former Beatle would have long-term and profound effects on Gary Wright the rest of his life. More on that later. What is at risk at reducing the story of Gary Wright's 1975 album, The Dreamweaver, merely to chart rankings and platinum sales awards is the far larger lasting impact as a musical pioneer that Gary Wright was by making the first hit album utilizing solely electronic keyboards and synthesizers in the arrangements. Here's Gary Wright with me in the studio.
Yeah, I feel good about that because I think it's probably true. I was the first all-keyboard band to be out there, the first, you know, one to have done it and used it a lot on my records. And now it's like, you know, now it's so much of it out there that's like ridiculous. Now there's a lot of records being made with no guitar. I mean, it's all keyboards or samples, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, I feel good in so much as that I was able to participate and start a movement, you know, in music and... you know, be one of the people that was, like you said, you know, on the cutting edge. I mean, I'm glad that I was able to do that. I'm happy.
Love is Alive was the first single released from the Dreamweaver album in July 1975.
Just had like a clavinet playing through an Echoplex and bass and a little Univox drum machine. And that's how the groove came, you know, of the verse. And then I had these other chord changes that I had written on guitar, which I just put those together for the chorus, The Love is Alive, and I just came up with the idea. And I wanted to make it a positive song because, again, I felt real positive at that stage of my life. And I wanted to, you know, let that feeling be translated through the music. So the song is, it's really about, you know, the power and the exhilaration and the great feeling of someone discovers love in their life. I wanted to do something that had a lot of air, that would feature the keyboard bass because it really hadn't been used. Stevie Wonder, I think, had used keyboard bass on some of his earlier albums, one or a couple of tracks. But it really had never been used, I don't think, to the degree it was on my album. So the whole sonic intent of the album was, one, to have a lot of spaciousness in it, not a lot of instruments playing things, and then everything that played something to really make it count. So it really just featured the grooves of the drums with the drum machine and the real strong bass lines, and everything else kind of was around that.
No, I don't need to travel far. And I don't need to be a star.
Chorus on Gary Wright's Made to Love You from his third solo album, 1975's The Dreamweaver, Gary began his musical performing career at only age 13 on Broadway in the production of the musical Fanny.
It was interesting for me, obviously. You know, I'd never done anything quite as big before, and it was quite an experience, you know, to go in and sing before a full-blown symphony orchestra, you know, that they have on Broadway, and it was quite an experience. I'm sure it formed the basis for which later on became a lot of my musical roots. That kind of, you know, show music as mixed together with rock and roll, because I was very much into early rock and roll at the time when it was all happening in New York. Well, I was kind of burnt out. You have to realize, you know, when you're 13 years old and you want to go to school, and at that time I was playing baseball and things like that, and having been through like 2 years of Broadway, like every, you know, six nights a week with two matinees a week, it was kind of a burning out experience, and I just wanted to leave all that behind me. I got offers for other Broadway shows. After that, I turned them all down because I didn't want to do them anymore. I really wanted to pursue a career, you know, in school, and at that time I was going to become a doctor. So that's where I had my sights set. And in the process of being in high school, I started to play. I taught myself how to play the piano. I had taken some classical lessons, but I really retaught myself, just sat down and learned all the old, you know, rock and roll songs, and gotten some bands, some earlier, you know, in the very early stages, some singing groups, and then got into a couple of high school bands. The first band I was in high school was with Ricky Nelson's cousin, Willie Nelson. That was in Tenafly High School in New Jersey. That was the first band that I was in, and then I got into college and played again on weekends and during the summer vacation, and my, you know, I was developing all the time.
Gary Wright wailing old school blue-eyed soul over the then-new pulsing synthesizer sound on Much Higher from the album The Dreamweaver. Here's Gary Wright.
I had always imagined my solos on the keyboards, which again at that time was Minimoog, to be what I would imagine myself playing like if I were a saxophone player. I used to love like this kind of solos that King Curtis used to play, and those guys, you know, the real good sax players. And so really that's, I guess I'm a frustrated sax player and a frustrated bass player. Welcome back in the studio for The Dreamweaver. I'm Gary Wright with Redbeard.
Thank you, Gary. After 7 years in London and Spooky Tooth's second breakup, Gary Wright returned home to New Jersey with a certain level of frustration.
I think Spooky Tooth could have been as big as any of the major bands that were successful had there been continuity in the career and the right kind of management, the right record company, which we really didn't have at the time. And we were a band that was, you know, the ideas and all that were ahead of its time. And I'd always approach my music like that. I would be very unhappy, even to this day now, of trying to make safe records for the, you know, just to satisfy the A&R people at the record companies. I'd rather than do something else in my life than to do that.
Since you came, I feel released.
blind feeling appears on Gary Wright's 1975 third solo album, The Dreamweaver, an innovative recording in rock history.
I decided that I was going to do something which I hadn't done before, because the other solo albums I had done, I had all really very fine musicians playing on them, and they were I thought they were really good albums. They were, you know, played a lot on the radio. They weren't commercially successful. But I decided I was going to do something that I'd never done before, just to try something, just go for it, and that was to do it with all keyboards. Because the idea came about, I had rented this little house in New Jersey, and I was writing songs, and I just had all my, you know, like, not synthesizers, but keyboards that I had used on stage during the very last tour of Spookytooth, which included a mini Moog and a clavinet and I think an arp string ensemble and an organ. And I wrote all my songs just using keyboards. And I thought, you know, that sounds fine to me. You know, why not just do an album with all keyboards? That had never been done before. Just get away from what you've been doing, which was Spookytooth, which was really a guitar or organ-oriented band. And so I went for it. And I played my demos to one of the guys who were working at Warner Brothers at the time, and he really liked them. So I decided to carry on with my idea and take it through right to the end. Well, I did it quite quickly, actually. I think I took about 6 or 8 weeks to do the whole thing. I was really organized, and I knew exactly what I wanted to do. What I did is I did all my basic tracks in like one week, like 5 or 6 days. I would be in the studio. I mean, typically it would be myself and David and Andy in the studio. David would play like Fender Rhodes, and I would be playing like arp string ensemble and keyboard bass. That was just to like get the drums and the piano on tape, and then I'd come back and I'd redo all my keyboard parts later on. So there was only really at any given time in the studio 3 players, the drummer, one keyboard player, and myself. And there was a book I had read that George had given me, George Harrison, called Whispers from Eternity, and it was written by Paramahansa Yogananda, who wrote the book Autobiography of a Yogi. And George had turned me on to Yogananda in the early 70s, and I had read all his literature. And as I read, you know, as I still do today, when I read things, I sometimes make little notes if I see a word or a phrase or something that might be a good idea for a song. And in one of the poems that Yogananda wrote, he was talking about God being the weaver of dreams of the cosmos, and I thought, Weaver of Dreams. Oh, Dreamweaver. That would be a good idea for a song. And I just wrote it down. And then later on, I was on I was still living in England. I went away one weekend with a friend of mine, and I had my acoustic guitar, and I just wrote the song and, you know, filed it away on cassette. And then that was one of the songs that I considered doing later on. So that's how the song got written. But I had never envisaged when I wrote it on acoustic guitar that it was going to sound anything like it turned out to be. The album was very much influenced by Paramahansa Yogananda, even though I wasn't, you know, like very much into it, his teachings at the time. It wasn't until after that album that I really became heavily involved in it. I'm sure his hand was there, you know, in the making of that album.
I've just closed my eyes again, climbed aboard the Dreamweaver train. Trying to take away my worries of today and leave tomorrow behind. Ooh, Dreamweaver, I believe you can get me through the night. Ooh, Dreamweaver, I believe we can reach the still may be some time. Fly me away to the bright side of the moon. Meet me on the other side.
The song Dreamweaver, that was the very last song that was put on the album. I was in the studio, it was myself, David Foster, and Jim Keltner, and I played David two songs, and one was Dreamweaver, and another one was a song that was on my second solo album. And I said, well, I've got these two last songs, which of these two do you think we should put on the album? And David said, I think I like Dreamweaver better. And it was like, really, it didn't even have the same feel as it wound up on the record. And David just played around for a minute, and he changed it from just being a straight four kind of thing into a shuffle. And I said, fine, that's great. And we just played it, laid down the basic track. And I thought, well, you know, this being the last song, you know, I never thought this would be a single or anything. I decided just to use it as like an experimental, the most experimental track on the album. And I put all the electronic effects, and all I used was a Mini Moog on that album and an Arp string ensemble as far as synthesizers and a Fender Rhodes. I just kind of like got as experimental as I could. The song was like 5 minutes long, you know, but I think in all stories, you know, I mean, you can look through the files of hits and hit movies and things like that, and there's always some story like that about that, you know, at the last minute somebody made a decision or something like that, and that became the huge thing. That's just, to me, that's just all part of, you know, the drama of this business of creation, whatever you want to call it. It just looks like it was just like a chance thing, but I don't think it was a chance in the slightest bit at all. I think it was definitely something that was meant to be. You know, karma, whatever you want to call it. I think when I had done that album, I was so frustrated from having been in Spooky Tooth and, you know, all the, you know, the attempts we tried and they didn't happen, and frustrated with the record companies and all that, that it was kind of like at that particular time, my last effort. I certainly don't feel like that anymore, because now, I mean, music is my life and I'm totally committed to it. To me, that was my success. I thought that that's great. You know, I've never had an album that was in the top 40 before, and I was satisfied right then and there. I had no idea, you know, that I would ever have a hit single. And then when the single started to take off, I just couldn't believe it. I mean, it happened all so quickly that I was just numb. You know, it just, and then the second one came out, and it was just all of a sudden, you know, you're like rocketed up into this area, you know, of like, all of a sudden your life becomes so busy you don't even have time to do anything anymore. And that's what happened. It just kind of like exploded, and everybody wanted, you know, for me to play or to do interviews and all that. It just became real hectic and busy. So I was taken off guard. I had no idea it was going to happen, obviously. Welcome back in the studio for The Dreamweaver. I'm Gary Wright with Redbeard.
Again, thank you, Gary. What happened was that Gary's The Dreamweaver album, the title song, admittedly the most experimental of the eight songs, it started to take off by the end of 1975 as a single. A full year after the album was released, Gary Wright had the number two selling single in America with the title song Dreamweaver, plus the number seven selling album. Then, Love is Alive was re-released a second time, and then it became a number two hit. On July 4, 1976, Gary Wright performed the U.S. Bicentennial Concert in Philadelphia, along with Peter Frampton and Yes, in front of an estimated 120,000 fans at the cavernous JFK Stadium. The innovation of all keyboards, which Gary Wright had displayed in the recording of the Dreamweaver in the studio, was really put to the test in the massive concert setting.
When I was in Spooky Tooth, I was always sitting behind a Hammond organ, and I was quite frightened to be the front man out front of the stage. So I had no idea really how I was going to do it. At first, you know, I was like, I want to do something, you know, that hadn't been done before. So I had this huge scaffolding constructed, and I was standing on this scaffolding, and the rest of the band were down below, but it kind of looked like I was a painter on this metallic scaffolding. And I had this Fender Rhodes set up, and, you know, and that was so impractical. So then I just got the idea of cutting down a mini Moog. And my tech at the time, my road manager, said it could be done, you know, and he called Moog, who were very cooperative at the time, and we cut down this little keyboard, and I think it was the first time it had ever been done. And so I put it around my neck and went out to the front of the stage for the first time, and I felt, wow, that's great. You know, it felt really good to do this, and from that point on, the whole show radically changed. And I started to then, you know, get a lot of confidence and walked around the stage and twirl the thing around my head and do all these little tricks and all that. And we did a lot with the lights and stuff like that. So it really opened up the show quite a lot.
Oh,
Gary Wright's Power of Love is the only song on the Dreamweaver album to feature guitar, and the legendary late electric guitarist Ronnie Montrose was invited to record on it. Here's Gary Wright.
I had the idea of putting guitar on that track because I thought, I mean, there was no way that would have sounded as good without guitar, although we did do it live on stage and it sounded fine without guitar, you know, so, but at the time I wanted to have like one, you know, a guitar on one track. So, yeah, that was the rock and roll track of the album. That song, I think I even wrote on a guitar and I put it down, and then I was fooling around with my Mini Moog one day and I learned this, you know, the modulation function of it, where you just turn up the modulation wheel and you get the bass to start pulsing in rhythm, you know. So that's really how it, you know, that don, don, don kind of bass line that goes throughout the song. I thought it was, you know, it was really like set up the feel. Lyrically, I can't remember exactly how that all came together, but I mean, I had the idea again as a song title, Power of Love, and I thought that was a real powerful kind of song, so I thought the lyrical idea and the music would marry well together. And Ronnie Montrose played the, you know, the guitar really well. I mean, that's exactly how I wanted the feel of the guitar to be. When you know that you have created something that has become a classic in music, it's obviously, you feel very uplifted when you hear it, you know, and good in a way, because I feel that my role as an artist really is to help people through my music in a healing sense, or however you want to say it. And I think to the degree that I can participate and do that, that's wonderful for me to feel that my music is able to, you know, touch people in that way.
Gary Wright later would re-record the song The Dreamweaver for a throwback fantasy scene in the hit 1992 comedy film Wayne's World. Gary toured on the 2004 Spooky Tooth reunion and with Ringo Starr's all-star band. Gary Wright has done film scores and solo albums in 2008 and 2010. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Gary Wright. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2014. All rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song, Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter. And for more, visit inthestudio.net.